I want you to go back to the Old Testament book of Numbers, a book that probably not too many of us read regularly, and I don't blame you, because it is at times an insufferably laborious and boring book. There are chapters and chapters of this guy had this many kids, and their kids were named this, and then they had kids named this, and they had kids named, and it goes on and on and on. The book is, literally, they were numbering the tribes. Now, as you find Numbers, your book, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, it's the fourth book in your Old Testament. I want you to turn to chapter 16. As you turn there, I'm going to give you a little background of the book, a little background of the story, and then actually we're just going to draw one main point tonight as application out of this story. I'm really not teaching what the story meant. I'm going to use the story to set it up, to kind of use as a visual illustration of a point that I think we could chew on for this week. Numbers. A lot of the first five books of the Bible perhaps were in their beginning stages, beginning to be accumulated by Moses. Moses traveled, and if you remember what's going on in the children of Israel, they come out of Egypt. Moses has led them. They're out in the wilderness for how many years? 40. And among this group now, some say it was anywhere from about 600,000 people had come out of the 400 years of being slaves in Egypt. Some say it might have been as many as 6 million. I don't know, but nevertheless, a big group of people. Out there, they're divided by clans. There are basically 12 tribes or descendants of 12 different patriarchs, and they've kept their clannish identity, and they will. In the years to come, as they move into what is today Israel, each of the clans will inherit different portions of the land. Well, the book of Numbers is basically the book when they got out there and they decide, well, we're going to move into the new property. We need to decide who the biggest tribes are, how many people really are out here, so let's do that. And so most of this book is rather tedious and really not, frankly, very applicable to our Christian lives today, because it is the numbering of the people. This tribe of Manasseh, let's name the leaders and how many, and let's go to the tribe of Benjamin and how many, and on they go. But ensconced within the pages are some incredible little vignettes and stories, characters we meet. So if you're reading through the Bible and you sometimes get to the boring chapters, don't give up on the book. Maybe just skip ahead to the next chapter, because there's some great ones in here. Chapter 16 has several stories, and perhaps I shouldn't use the word great, because they're rather odd and at times even macabre stories. I want to look at one beginning down near the end of the chapter at verse 41. Now, as you know, one of the things that were going on is the Israelis, as they wandered through the wilderness, was that they really weren't happy with how things were going. I mean, they weren't happy in Egypt being slaves, but now they're out here in the wilderness. They don't even have permanent homes. I found in human life, as much as we don't like our routines sometimes, the safety and the comfort of a routine is oftentimes better than the fear of the unknown. And although they had been slaves and they were being worked to death out here, they're not sure what life is even about and where they're going and where they're going to get food next week. And one of the problems they are wrestling with is they're just constantly complaining. Moses, you brought us out here and we're tired of this food and we don't know. Just on and on and on. So in verse 41, and here begins one of these stories where I'm going to say, I think this is their understanding of God. We'll talk about that as we read it, because God is rather irascible in this story. On the next day, all the congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, that was his brother, saying, "You've killed the people of the Lord." I don't have time to go into that story, but right earlier in this chapter, there were some people who had also complained, and they were starting a rebellion, and God's judgment came upon them, and they died. So even though the bad guys die, the people are mad, and they're like, "Moses, Aaron, you killed our friends here." So they're complaining. Verse 42. Now it happened when the congregation had gathered against Moses and Aaron, that they turned toward the tabernacle of meeting. In the middle of the camp, if you can kind of look down from a bird's eye view, 600,000 people in some big valley, and there's tents, and they're in their little clans, and they have the communities. But in the middle is the tent. This is their center. This is their church. This is a thickly woven covering of ram skins and other cloths, and inside is where they worship God, and they are making some furniture that will, for years in Israel, be very precious to them. This will be what will later on in Solomon's time become the great temple of Jerusalem. But right now it's called the tabernacle. It was a temporary thing that when they moved camp, they folded it up and moved to the next place. So they turned toward the tabernacle, and suddenly a cloud covered it. And that to them represented the glory of the Lord was among them. Verse 43. So Moses and Aaron came before the tabernacle of meeting. Remember, this is before Jesus. The New Testament teaches that you don't have to now come to a preacher to have access to God. You can go to God every morning and talk to God. You can commune while you drive. You can talk to God in the shower. But before Jesus Christ, people usually went to a priest, to someone who was a holy person, to say, here's my gifts, here's what I need, can you go talk to God? So the people are like, Moses, we see cloud coming down, what's going on? And so Moses and Aaron run into the tabernacle and they go to see what God is wanting to say, and it's not real good. 44, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, get away from among this congregation. That's my God voice, my best try. That I may consume them in a moment. And Moses and Aaron fell on their faces. So in case you just lost it, what's happened is these people have been complaining. We just had an episode where God had to do some house cleaning before. Now the people are complaining again about the leadership. Remember, these people had been slaves, or kids were being killed. God said, Moses, I'll use you. Go bring them out. And now they're complaining about this guy who's just trying to help them. God is like, I'm through. At least that's what the story is saying. He said, Moses, Aaron, get away from them, because I'm going to wipe them out.
That's what he says. What a day this is.
Verse 46. So Moses said to Aaron, I love this. He's not going to listen to God. He says, Aaron. This is what I mean by, I don't want to dwell on this, but you really have to be careful. If you think you take stories in a very literal way, you have a problem theology here, because you have already God saying, move aside because I'm going to kill every single one of them. And then you have Moses saying, I don't care what you say, God, I'm going to do something else. So understand, maybe it's not a play-by-play little, maybe it's a very ancient story representing something we'll look at in just a minute. But Moses says to Aaron, Aaron, I want you to take a censer. By the way, does anyone remember how old Moses is about now? He's in his 80s. He didn't even go to Egypt to get the Hebrews until he was 80. So he's an old man. So no wonder he says to his younger brother, Aaron, go get the censer. The censer was the bowl where they kept the incense and the fire burning. It represented their prayers. And they always kept it burning. There was always smoke coming up from the tabernacle, representing the prayers and the worship of God's people that were constantly coming up before God. Aaron, go get the censer. Put fire in it from the altar. Put incense on it. And take it quickly to the congregation. Make atonement for them. For the wrath has gone out from the Lord, and the plague has begun. Because look what's happened. Verse 47, that Aaron took it as Moses commanded. You can kind of see him there in the tabernacle. Quickly he grabs the censer and he grows, gets on the altar and gets the tool and gets the incense and the coals. And he runs out of there, flipping back the fabric to that tabernacle, runs into the middle of the people. Hundreds of thousands of people are gathered because according to the story, a plague has begun to hit among the people. So he ran. Aaron ran into the middle of the assembly. And already the plague had begun among the people. And so he put the incense down in the ground and he made atonement. Oh God, forgive these people. I don't know what he said. They don't know. They don't mean it. Lord, have mercy upon us. You can see this image of this man pleading with God in the middle of these people. They're beginning to just die. Literally, it's just kind of, if you could see it in a dramatic movie some way, there's just people beginning to fall as thousands of them are dying. God, please. But I love verse 48, and this is the picture I want you to see. And Aaron stood between the dead and the living, so the plague was stopped. Those who died in the plague were 14,700. Again, coming back to the story, I want you to be very careful. I had a guy 2 months ago, I saw him on Sunday morning, and he had been over in that room for Sunday school. And I greeted him there, and then 5 minutes later he was sitting out here for our service. And I said, oh, you decided not to go to Sunday school. And this man said to me, well, they announced a reading from the Old Testament. I can't stand the Old Testament, so I'm coming in here to church. And I said, well, hope April's not preaching from the Old Testament this morning. But I hear their reaction, and it's frankly because of stories like this that we have a problem with a God who's like, you know what? It's my last straw. Wiping you guys out. That's why I took time to answer Joey's question. Please understand that that's not that this is not truth. This is the truth as people were understanding it in their day. Their understanding was that when a plague began, they didn't believe, and even at this time, there was no theology of a devil. There was a God. They believed in a God that was all-powerful. So if bad or good things are happening, it must be God. That's how they viewed the world. And so this plague is going, and their understanding is, you know why this has happened? Because you people are bitter and complaining and rebellious against God, and so God is wiping you out. I don't think that's really the understanding of what God was doing. But the writers 3,000 years ago who are writing this, that's their understanding of it happening. But what is powerful, however it played out, was what happens in the story. And that is, as Aaron runs out and says, you know what, I see people dying, and I see that maybe some even think they deserve it. You could say, well, according to justice, according to God's justice, according to the Bible, they deserve it because they did bad, and God's judgment is coming upon them, so let them go. God, all your ways are good. Have your way, O Lord, have your way. But he's not content with that. Aaron and Moses see people that even though they are complaining about them, even though these people are rascals and they are causing them uncomfort and they're not listening to them and they are belligerent at times, something in that compassionate old man said, God, you can't wipe these people out. We've come too far. Aaron, quick, go get the prayer and stand out among those people where they're dying and do something. And I love the picture of him standing out there, putting that down on the ground, saying, God, have mercy. And where he stood, the plague stopped. On this side, they're dead. And on this side, there's life. According to this story, what would have happened maybe if Aaron had not gone? What would have happened if they would have listened and said, God wants us to just move aside? Oh, that is tragic. Good thing we're here in the tabernacle where God's presence is. Look at those people dying out there. Let's have a prayer meeting. But he doesn't do that. He goes out there where it's dangerous. He goes out there where they're dying. He goes out there where the religion is saying, don't even mess with that right now. It's over. He gets personally vested out there. And because of that, God stops that plague. I'm preaching this because about a month ago, Pastor April mentioned this scripture on a Sunday morning. She didn't really look at it from the aspect. But when she mentioned this, and I went home that afternoon, as I often do, and I kind of read through the story again, such a poignant picture jumped out to me of what God's people should be in a culture. I believe we use words and we don't use them outside of church, so maybe we should define it, but we are a redemptive people. The reason I believe God changes us and leaves us here is to be in San Diego, to be in California, to be in our nation, to be at your workplace, to be in your school, to be in your apartment building, a force of redemptive, creative God in that place. People, I don't have to preach this point to know that if you look around our culture, there are all kinds of plagues that are destroying people's lives. Some of them are very overt. I mean, we could talk about the over one. Well, we know that methamphetamine use is killing many of our young people, and we know that there are sexually communicable diseases that have taken thousands, and we know there's this, but there's many other things that are going on too that bring destruction to people's lives. There's child abuse that a lot of us don't see. I was shocked this week when I read 4 children a day die because of child abuse in this nation. 4, most of them under the age of 4 years old. And out of all the ones that aren't killed, can you imagine how many are spoken to in a horrible way by a parent or a caregiver in anger, calling them names? What about the plagues of low self-esteem? What about the plagues of addiction of all sorts? But all these things that are destroying, killing, maybe not always physically, but destroying people's joy, destroying relationships, destroying communities, injustices, greed that's destroying banking systems. I mean, there are plagues on every way we look that are literally bringing death upon us. And God has charged us as his people to be a redemptive agent, to be someone that literally goes and stands in the middle of it and says, stop! God, have mercy! What can I do to literally stand in the middle of this and say, I've got to do something to see this plague stopped? All through the Bible we see that. People who said, I'll do something. from the beginning of Genesis to the last book of the Bible, you'll see redemptive people who will get involved and say, use me. I don't have much, but here's a little. So I have a little voice. I have a little sheep. I have this. I have a little bit of flour. I have something. And God says, that's all. Because realize, it's really not about all about you. It's God saying, I just need one person to go stand in the middle of the plague, and I'll connect and do the rest. I remember the day I was trying to start my first church up in Seattle, and I was really young. I think I was 21 at that time, and I couldn't get people to come. Nobody wanted to come. I don't blame them now. I think back at that. But. So I would go out there, and I would knock on doors. And so I had this little route that I would always do. I had several routes, but this was my A route. And I would go pick up the kids and bring them to church, and I would try to talk to their parents. Well, there was this one girl I kind of avoided, frankly, because she kind of intimidated me. I knew the kids had told me she was a drug dealer, and I usually saw her out on the basketball court, and she knew who I was, although we'd never really had much dialogue, and when I would come by, she'd call me Preach. She'd say, hey, Preach, what's up? I was like, hi, how you doing? And I didn't know if she was making fun of me or what, but I kind of left her alone, and so this one day, they weren't playing basketball that day, so I had to actually go up into the apartments and knock on the doors to get the kids. And I knew she lived in this unit, and there was always, you know, a lot of people come in and out, loud, whatever. And so I went, started to go toward her door, and I turned away and I thought, no, I don't want to go there. I don't know why. I don't know what I was thinking. I just didn't want to go, whatever. I don't know. I'm scared. I don't know if it's more energy than I need to exert. I just didn't want to go. And I started to walk away. And I'm not being spooky. I don't mean like a vision, like, ooh, something happened weird. But I did. A picture came to my mind just as I literally, and it literally was so vivid to me, I stopped. And I saw in my mind this picture of Jesus. Not really what he looked like, but I saw this like image in my mind of Christ, and however you would think, if you know, put on the robe or whatever, with arms outstretched. And I knew immediately that was a sign of welcoming, a sign of love. But I noticed that where the garment ended, where the sleeves were, I didn't see anything. There were no hands. And the still small voice of the Holy Spirit said, the only hands the Lord has on this street are yours. Now, I don't mean in a universal way, but he meant at that moment, Jesus is not going to knock on her door. You are his hands. And I turned around and I went back scared and I knocked on her door, kind of softly in case she didn't want to be disturbed. And I'll never forget, as the door flung open so quickly it just scared me, and she looked at me, tears, just swollen eyes, and said, Preach! And she just fell on me and sobbed. It took me a long time to even get her to talk to see what was going on. She had just lost her partner, her girlfriend, that morning in a shooting, and was devastated by the news. Did not know where to turn. Had not darkened the door of a church in less than she was like a little girl, she told me, in Sunday school. That was the day that God said, you're my hands on the street. Go knock on the door. And that day, me not even realizing what was happening, I stood between the living and the dead. I stood between a girl who would later, because she became an active member of our church in the next year and a half that I was at that church, who said that day I was ready to blow my brains out because I loved her and she was gone. And then knock, 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 this little preacher boy knocks on my door to invite me to church. That's the kind of thing God wants us doing. The kind of thing where two young men up in San Francisco said, we have a lot of friends who are dying because they've infected HIV through dirty needles. We're going to get places to find clean needles and power. Well, I know church, but well, they shouldn't be using that. That's not the point. The point is, well, should we save these people because they've been complaining against God? Yes, they should be saved. And now they have a whole ministry up in San Francisco. I shouldn't say a ministry, it's not even a church thing. Where they go and they pass out clean needles. Places like Mama's Kitchen here in San Diego. People like Dave who go to the hospice week in and week out. People say, you know what? I can do something to go and stand where there is death, where there are people dying, where there are people hurting, where there are people suffering. And I can make a difference. I'm not sure how it will always happen. It may be in a small way. And as I was thinking of this week, I thought, you know what? This happens in a small way when my mother every couple months goes and gives blood at the blood drive. In small ways, redemptive people understand what I have, I will give to help those. It happens in ways when we take two people I know that used to come to my church every summer. They were retirees and they had a big old RV. And they would spend almost 8 months of their year traveling from church to church with their tools, fixing doors, replacing windows, fixing water heaters, air conditioning units. That just saying we can do something. God can use us where there are hurting people to touch lives. This has really been on my heart the last month. And I think the reason is because in my journey, and I'll talk about us here at this church because some of us have been here for a while, this was a place of healing for me, coming back to faith, coming back to an understanding of God's love for me. And it's become a family for me. But over the last months, and now that I'm in pastoral leadership here at this church, I really think that God is saying something to this church to say, but this isn't just a place we come into the tabernacle to give our prayers and to give our worship and to love each other and to be all that that is good, but to understand that we've been here as a redemptive people to go out there where people are hurting, where families are disintegrating, where relationships are leaving people devastated, where people are losing their homes, and say, we can do something that is redemptive in this place. I don't know what it'll be for you. I know kind of what God is dealing with me about and what I'm to do. But I want you in the weeks to come to begin to pray about that. God, what can I do? How can I go stand in the middle of a plague? Where can I go that people are hurting? Where can I go that there's death in some way, and be a light? I was going to show it. I'm not going to have time. But one of the things I want you to think about, because I think I wouldn't mind having some of you help. I'm going to go back and do something that are kind of my roots in ministry. Statistic, I was at the gym about 6 weeks ago running, dying. And it came on, this whole thing many of you saw it about. In America, more and more the growing number of people that say they claim no faith. They're not any religion, and it's getting up to like 15 or 17% now. People say, we're not anything. We don't go to any kind of church. And I do think that's a worrisome thing. I think that active faith in your life is important. I remembered something small. I thought, you know, back in my grandma's day or my parents' day, because it really didn't even happen in my day, many church people brought neighborhood kids to church. They just loaded them up in the car. Or churches had buses that went throughout the neighborhoods and took all the church. So you had this whole generation, even of people, if your parents didn't go, you might have an opportunity to come and learn about David and Goliath and Moses and Noah. We don't do that anymore. I thought, I just moved into this new community and there are kids everywhere. And they are already playing and dirty and getting into trouble when I leave for church on Sunday morning. I know they're not going anywhere. I'm going to go to my neighbors and say, I go to church on Sunday morning. I'd love to take your kids to Sunday school with me if I could. But another thing that I'm going to begin doing, and this is where you can begin thinking about it if you wouldn't mind helping, maybe it'll be once a month, maybe more. When I started my ministry years ago in Seattle, we started what we called Sidewalk Sunday School. We realized we can't get all the kids in here, but some of these apartment complexes and big things, tons of kids. We would take Sunday school to them. On a Saturday morning, on a Sunday morning, on a Saturday afternoon, depending what the shift was, we had a couple volunteers, we'd have our boards, we'd have our balloons, we'd have a clown outfit, we'd have snacks, and we would go with our big horn, and we would sometimes have as little as 10, but many times by the time I left Seattle, we had our big Saturday morning, was over 300 kids packed into this little rundown building, come from all over the neighborhood, and they would hear of Jesus, and they would hear of God's love, and they would memorize scriptures, and they would play games. And even as in the years went by, last time in Seattle, I saw some of those kids who are now adults, have children of their own. They say, you know, we're in church today still because you brought us to Sunday school when we were little kids. I can't change the world, but God says, if there's a plague where you are, RC, you can step in and do something about it. Where is the plague in your life that you see? Where are the people God has you around who are hurting? Where are there people going through devastation that you can somehow say, I'll be a redemptive agent of change. I'll stand between the living and the dead. Let's bow our heads.